Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The regulation two guests in two segments today. Jeet here will analyze the recent Canadian election, and the political scientist Natasha Piano will talk about the Italian school of elite theory. Canada first. On April 28th, Canada held a national election in which the incumbent Liberal Party got the most votes, though short of a majority. Since it's a parliamentary system, the party's leader, Mark Carney, became the prime minister, a position he'd already held thanks to the resignation of his predecessor, Justin Trudeau. Trudeau and his government had been deeply unpopular, and it was universally believed that the Conservative Party, led by Pierre Poilievre, would win. Trudeau himself was so unpopular that he resigned as party leader, and therefore prime minister, and was succeeded by Carney in March. That succession was confirmed by the recent election. Carney was initially read as a caretaker. Then Donald Trump started talking about annexing Canada, and everything changed. Here to explain the election and the general landscape of Canadian politics is the journalist Jeet here. Jeet is paradoxically the national correspondent for The Nation, even though he's Canadian, a fact unmentioned on his Nation bio page. But hey, whatever, we're internationalists at Behind the News. Jeet here. What happened to Trudeau? He was prime minister not that long ago, and then Trump made a lot of fun of him, and he kind of disappeared.
Trudeau came in, like, in 2015, and I think he, like, really belonged to that era. That was the tail end of the Obama era, and he was a hope and change, youthful energy politician. After that initial election victory, he did not fare well. Like, he got then two minority governments in a row. Once the COVID situation hit, he suffered all the same sort of popularity problems that politicians across the Western world have. For the last 2 years, and this precedes Trump, the Conservative Party under Pierre Poilievre has enjoyed double-digit lead. For the last 2 years, everyone was expecting that once there's an election, the Conservatives would win a very strong majority. So Trudeau was already on the way out. The crisis that Trump introduced to Canadian politics clarified the issue for the Liberal Party, and they decided they had to get rid of Justin, which turned out to be a very wise move. And once Trudeau, with his personal unpopularity, was out of the way, the Liberals were able to rebrand as the Party of National Sovereignty.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the party. What forces, what social base does the Liberal Party represent historically?
The first thing to understand about the Liberal Party is it is the most successful centrist political formation in the Western world. In the 20th century, the Liberal Party was in power 70 out of 100 years. It is the default governing party, the natural governing party of Canada. And it does so by occupying a space in the political center. It is liberal, partially in the old 19th century sense. The party of property, and the party that is aligned with Bay Street, the Canadian equivalent of Wall Street, the party of the sort of central Canadian elite, the Laurentian elite, as it's known in Canada. Occupying that center space, it has been very adroit at balancing French and English-Canadian national interest. It represents the federalist part of French Canada, the part of French Canada that wants to be part of the Canadian polity, that is not sovereigntist. And it represents the centrist wing of English Canada. One interesting thing is that they take this very seriously, and they alternate between English and French leaders, and have done so for a century. And I think that alternation allows them to speak to this middle-of-the-road position within Canadian politics, and positions the Conservatives, more importantly, as the party of English Canada. And this is a real problem that the Conservative Party has always had, that except in rare situations where people are very angry at the Liberal Party, people in Quebec do not vote for the Conservatives. And if they are mad at the Liberals, they often vote for the sovereigntists. And so it's very hard for the Conservatives to get that kind of majority strength that you need to govern. The Liberals are basically the party of the sort of center-left, but maybe more center than left. In some ways, a lot like the Democrats, but also, I think, much more politically successful and politically adroit than the Democrats.
And then the Conservative Party.
If the Liberal Party's base is in central Canada, like Ontario, Quebec, with smatterings in the maritime provinces, the Conservatives are really the party of the western part of the country, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and stronger in British Columbia, although that's very divided between the three major parties. The Conservatives, when they are successful, when they have a successful leader like Brian Mulroney, or even Stephen Harper, for his last term, they are able to make inroads in Ontario, in Atlantic Canada, and especially with Brian Mulroney, which made him very interestingly an exception in Canadian history. He made like really strong inroads in Quebec. It's a Western base, but they can have outreach. And if they have enough outreach into central Canada, they can win.
How conservative are they? And as a party, but also how Poilievre, how conservative is he?
They've gone through like a lot of changes. And one thing is we have a policy of multiculturalism. And this was introduced by a conservative prime minister, John Diefenbaker, who also ran into a lot of problems with the Kennedy administration because he didn't want missiles in the Arctic and through NORAD. And the Kennedy administration worked with the liberals to depose of Diefenbaker. So that's a conservative politician. Brian Mulroney was a successful conservative politician. You know, the country that Canada gave the most foreign aid to when Mulroney was prime minister, it was Nicaragua. So within an American context, this is like very much a kind of like center-right party of the old Nelson Rockefeller mode. I mean, the conservatives, they have members who are very right-wing, who want to get rid of abortion, but the Conservative Party in Canada, their official policy is that they won't touch abortion. Having said that, they are the party of big business and of continental integration. They've increasingly taken on, as a lot of right-wing parties in the Western world have, an increasingly sort of populist anti-system politics with a lot of anger directed towards things like public health care measures, public broadcasting. And I think this is a kind of like a newer element in their politics, which for a lot of people turning out to be very scary. But they've also, like a lot of right-wing populist parties, are now making overtures to the working class. That's the more significant and worrying aspect of recent Canadian politics.
It looked like the Liberals were going to get creamed, and then Trump opened his mouth. Recite that history for us.
As I said, Trudeau was very unpopular. For the last 2 years, everyone was expecting a conservative majority. But I think Trump changed the equation, you know, once he started talking about Canada as a 51st state, and really revived the issue of Canadian nationalism and Canadian national sovereignty. And I think the Liberals, as the natural governing party, as the party that has the widest national reach and has governed so long and so successfully, were able to present themselves as we're the party that can stand up for Canadian national sovereignty. And in doing so, they absorbed a lot of the vote of several parties we haven't mentioned, which is the NDP, the Social Democratic Party, and the Bloc Québécois, the Quebec Sovereignist Party, which is also a very strong social democratic party. The election result was basically that the Liberals were able to rally the sort of, you know, national sovereignty issue and absorb the social democratic vote. Both the NDP and the Bloc lost a significant number of seats and votes. And conversely, the Conservatives managed to pick up the anti-system, mad at the status quo in Canada vote. They also absorbed some of the votes from the NDP. I mean, it's interesting that some of the success that the Conservatives had was in the sort of old industrial heartland of Canada. Places like Hamilton, Windsor, these would be the sort of, you know, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia areas of Canada where the NDP has been traditionally very strong and where the Conservatives picked up vote. So in terms of the overall results, I mean, both the Liberals and the Conservatives gained, right? So the Liberals went from like 160 seats roughly to 169, and they increased their share by 11.2%. But the Conservatives went from 120 to 143, so they gained 13 seats, and they increased by 7.6. Conversely, the NDP lost. They lost from 24 seats to 7, and they lost 11.5%. And they've had the lowest showing since they've existed as a party in the last 60 years. Usually they get at least 15% of the vote. This time they got 6.3% of the vote. And the Bloc also went down from 33 seats to 23 seats, losing 1.5%. And the Green Party went from 2 seats to 1 seat, losing 1.2%. The three sort of smaller parties of the center-left, social democratic nature, all lost seats, and they went to the Liberals, but some of them went to the Conservatives, and I think that's a very worrying thing.
So the popular vote was pretty narrow, 2.5 points separated total popular votes. The parliamentary seats, the Liberals don't have a majority. They have to operate in coalition. What does this, the narrowness of these results, mean for the government of the future?
I think it makes it much more difficult for Mark Carney to govern. He will have to govern, as you said, in a coalition. Most likely with the NDP, even though it's been diminished, the Liberals plus the NDP will give you a majority. And traditionally in Canadian history, the best periods are where you actually have a Liberal minority and NDP making up the difference, because then the Liberals have to make concessions. And notably, you know, under Justin Trudeau, when the NDP was a little bit stronger, we had the NDP's demand was that we have to have dental care, expand the Canadian universal health care to include dental care. From a left perspective, like, that's almost the best you can hope for in Canada right now, is, like, you know, Liberals plus NDP. But in terms of governing, and especially in terms of governing with Trump in the White House, I think you could make an argument that what the Liberals wanted and what might have been desirable is, like, a Liberal majority that can then present a unified national front.
I'm speaking with the Canadian journalist, Jeet Heer. Okay, you wanted to do a little theoretical reflection, so...
We're used to thinking of things in left-right terms, which I think still applies, but I think that it's also very useful to think in terms of broadly pro-system and anti-system politics, which cut across left-right divide. There's a very good book on sort of like anti-system politics from a fellow named James Hopkin at London School of Economics. Basically, what he argues is with the global war on terror and then the financial meltdown, you had the emergence of anti-system politics, of people who thought the basic establishment is corrupt and evil and needs to be torn down, which I have to say I agree with. But this cut across like left and right, that you saw both sort of like populist movements of the left, Bernie Sanders in America, Corbyn in England, various movements in Europe, and also, you know, the more familiar right-wing populism, of which Trump is the most famous example. Interestingly enough, I think even, you know, in 2008, Barack Obama, even though he was a centrist, was able to harness a lot of the anti-system anger and win the largest majority in recent American history, because he said, you know, I'm running on hope and change. I'm going to turn the page on the old politics, not just the George W. Bush, but of the Clintons. We're not going to do stupid wars, and, you know, we need to revisit the trade deals. But, you know, like, Obama obviously governed as a centrist, but in 2012, he was blessed with having an opponent who was Mr. System. Mitt Romney, who's like from Bain's Capital, and who basically, you know, you could plausibly say he made his money through gutting the American working class. Anti-system politics helped the Democrats under Obama. But in 2016, with Obama gone, the Trump phenomenon makes sense if you realize the Republicans with Trump were able to harness anti-system anger and energy on the trade deals, on immigration, and on the global liberal order, right? Like NATO and all these things, and say that these are not good for the American people. And Trump won. And, you know, like in 2020, I think he suffered from becoming the face of the system, and a lot of anti-system anger went to the Democrats, even though they had Joe Biden. And also, I mean, I think the more significant development in America was that the anti-system forces on the left were defeated by Hillary Clinton and absorbed, or as junior partners, Sanders and AOC. Now, in Canada, what one sees is this kind of same pattern where the rise of the radical right has created a center left that really like pushes itself as pro-system. Hillary Clinton and I think Kamala Harris, they ran as pro-system politicians. They said, we're qualified. We know we have resumes. We know the record. We're willing to work bipartisan with Republicans. Their whole message was a pro-system message against the supposed threat of Trump as an anti-system politician. And I think something similar has happened here in Canada. Poilievre has basically absorbed a lot of the anti-system arguments, even though in a lot of ways he's a conventional business conservative. His slogan was, Canada is broken. And this is running off of the, you know, widespread feeling in the country that we have a cost of living crisis, we have a housing crisis, and the conservatives spoke to that. And they also made some very intelligent outreach to the working class. Poilievre talks against, like, you know, the billionaires and the yacht owners in the sort of language of right-wing populism. The Liberals, like the Democrats, have responded to this anti-system politics by becoming the party of the status quo. And one saw this with Trudeau's finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, who responded to the slogan, Canada is broken, by saying, Canada has never been broken, which called to mind Hillary Clinton, who responded with, Make America Great Again, by saying, America has always been great. So this message that Canada has never been broken, or America has always been great, is like a status quo message. It's saying, like, things are fine. We just need technocrats who can, like, work around the edges.
Things are great for the likes of Hillary and Chrystia and their friends, but that rings hollow to a lot of people.
To me, it's very worrying. And, you know, Mark Carney, you know, we haven't talked about him, but, you know, he came in after Trudeau. He was able to push Freeland aside. And this is someone who has, A, no political record to speak of, never ran for office before, but is quintessentially a man of the system. Studied at the best British universities, came out of university, went to work for Goldman Sachs, became then the governor of the Bank of Canada and then the Bank of England.
We've seen central bankers become politicians before, but mostly as caretakers or technocrats. But it's really wild. This guy ran two major central banks. That's quite unusual.
And then afterwards, you know, ran a hedge fund. And so to my mind, in an age of anti-system rage, running a central banker seems like the worst possible thing to do. But, I mean, Carney obviously won, but he won because Trump changed the equation. Before Trump started talking about Canada as a 51st state, the real debate was, is Canada broken or is it not? And the Conservatives were going to win on that, right? Canada is broken is a great message. But once Trump came into power and said he wants to annex Canada, the question becomes, should Canada survive as a nation? And that's something that the Liberals could win on, especially since the Conservative Party, with their base in Alberta and the sort of populist right, they have a lot of people that seem very Trumpian. This quintessential centrist politician of Mark Carney is able to win because Trump is seen as a foreign threat, and to win essentially a kind of centrist, you know, like, let's all unite together. But I personally don't think that this is like a very viable politics, especially since in the election, even though this is the best possible circumstances for the Liberal Party, the Conservatives gained votes, and they gained votes among A, working class voters. They gained votes among the young, and they gained votes among immigrant communities. What Carney is offering is essentially a very sort of nostalgic Canadian nationalism. Like, he talks about, you know, the CBC and shows like Mr. Dress Up, a popular show, hockey, Tim Hortons. And I think this sort of like is a very thin gruel of nationalism that I think appeals to basically Anglo boomers most of all. And I think that was really the demographic base. And Carney himself is a very, you know, it's not just that he's a central banker, but his whole orientation, he's what in Canada we used to call a red Tory, which used to be strong in the Conservative Party, but we're shifted to the Liberals now. He's invited King Charles to open the new Parliament, right? Which is something that has not been done. I don't think it's ever been done before. And he's also said, you know, Canada is the most European nation in the Western Hemisphere, and he wants to join the EU. So this is a guy whose basic orientation is very, very Eurocentric, very looking towards old institutions like NATO. And I don't know about you, Doug, but like, I don't see a future in that.
No, that does not. But, you know, I have to say, I've watched some clips of him, and since we have a president who doesn't even know what the Declaration of Independence is about, it was amazing to see this guy talking about economic policy with a great deal of sophistication.
If I wanted to describe Mark Carney, I would say he is the smartest member of the liberal technocratic class. And he has a book out called Values, which is very instructive. He is as aware as you and I, and as anyone listening to this program, about the crisis that is facing the world. He's aware of climate change. He's aware of economic inequality. He talks about this in the book. But his solution, it's in the title, Values, is that we need the business class to relearn values and to relearn commitment to a better society. So basically, I would say it's almost like a Charles Dickens liberalism. Like, it's like, you know, you have Ebenezer Scrooge, who's mean and a miser and mistreats Tiny Tim. But if he had just is visited by ghosts and has a change of heart, and, like, you know, he will share some of his wealth with the poor, right? And I love Charles Dickens, and I love A Christmas Carol, but I actually don't think that 19th century vision of, like, a moral reformation of capitalism is in the cards.
Yeah, well, the value these guys care about most is shareholder values. I don't think.
Well, no, exactly. No, but having said that, he is the smartest member of the technocratic class, and even though I think the election was a disaster for the social democratic left in Canada, and a lot of those people voted for Liberals. I mean, I've gone to, like, meetings with a lot of NDP voters, and said they were scared of Trump, and they said for the first time in their life they're going to vote for the Liberals. So I think Carney's aware that a lot of his support comes from that. There's a couple of interesting announcements. He's going to give strong, sustained funding for the CBC, which I think is good, right? for the Canadian National Broadcasting. He wants to have Via Rail, the national rail system, free for people under 18, which I think is good. And he wants to extend the dental care that Trudeau and the NDP had initiated to, like, more people. And I think that that's especially very good. He's not quite Joe Biden. He's, like, a little bit better than Joe Biden, right? And even Biden had some progressive economic policies. But I think Carney is very aware that there has to be some sacrifice. But having said that, like, on a lot of other issues, on in terms of fossil fuels, climate, taxes on capital gains, he has basically moved to the right and absorbed the Conservative Party. I mean, that is the Liberal Party. They're a centrist party that absorbs policy ideas from both the Conservatives and the Social Democratic left.
We're recording this as Carney and Trump are meeting in D.C. And just before I started up the machines, I got a bulletin from the New York Times that quoted Carney as saying Canada was not for sale, and Trump's response was never say never. So what has this sort of talk from Trump done to Canada's feelings about the U.S.?
It's very interesting that, like, on a very level of normie politics, I have three daughters and they play soccer, so we go to, you know, soccer games. Like, you know, you will see, like, people who are average middle-class people, like, be very anti-American.
They weren't that way before.
No, they weren't. I mean, I think Canadians in general, I mean, there used to be an older anti-Americanism that came out of Canadian ties to the British Empire, right? And that's obviously gone away for a long time. And under NAFTA, there's been a lot of continental integration and a lot of friendliness towards the United States. But you see people at the supermarkets, like, all the goods are kind of like marked now, so we can see what's an American product and what's a Canadian. And there's a large popular boycott. I have a cousin who's not very political, but she and I were talking about vacation plans. I wanted to go down to New York with her, but she said, no, I'm not going to go to America. You know, like, this is, like, not a lefty. There's a lot of bitterness. And one sees it at the hockey games, where the American national anthem plays is, like, booing. Carney, I was very interesting to hear Carney. He said, you know, our relationship with the United States has changed. We're not have that level of trust. And usually people like Carney, the people of the centrist Canadian elite, are the most continentalist. They're the most in favor of integration. So I think that there has been a really profound shift. And I know, you know, you're a bit skeptical of Canadian nationalism, but I will say that, like, historically, Canadian nationalism, when it's been successful, has had a substance. It has had a collective project. In the 19th century, it was a sort of, you know, unfortunately, the colonial settler project of settling the West and building the railway. But, you know, in the 20th century, Canadian nationalism meant building a national healthcare system. It meant supporting Canadian cultural industries, supporting the CBC. It meant, like, national bilingualism. And right now, what I'm seeing is a lot of national sentiment, but you don't see the sort of collective imagination of, like, what does it mean to, like, build a country and hold it together? And I think that that's probably going to have to be the next step. And I think that that opens up the room, despite the, you know, fact that the centrist party won, that does open up a room for a more utopian imagination.
How is the journalist G here? My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. They put a hot wire to my head, 'cause of the things I didn't say, and maybe see it in your way, but I'll see this in every way. Was some of Rise by Public Image Limited. Next, elites. They're hard enough to live with, but can we live without them? To consider that, let's turn to the Italian school of elitism, a name for three writers, Vilfredo Pareto, Gaetano Mosca, and Robert Michels, who made careers of studying social hierarchies. The standard interpretation of the school is that they think hierarchies are inevitable, but my guest Natasha Piano doesn't agree. A few words about each. Pareto is probably the best known of the three, mainly for economics. In this context, his most important contribution is the notion of the circulation of elites. They come and go. History, he said, is a graveyard of aristocracies. Mosca argued that societies are divided into two classes, a ruling minority and a ruled majority. He found no exceptions. Mosca emphasized the manipulation of the masses as key to elite rule, more so than Pareto, who had kind words for violence. Michels is most famous for a concept known as the Iron Law of Oligarchy, that with time, any organization, and this is an observation he developed by studying the German Social Democratic Party, will produce an elite more interested in preserving its status and power than advancing the original goals of the organization. When I first started studying ruling classes around 15 years ago, I adhered to a standard leftist belief that they could be overcome, not specific ruling classes, but the general structure of rulers and ruled. The Italians are a part of my reconsideration of that faith. Now I think that in any conceivable future, we have to watch elites, make them accountable and replaceable, but the time when they will disappear is far, far away. In her new book, Democratic Elitism, The Founding Myth of American Political Science, Natasha Piano, assistant professor of political theory at UCLA, argues that contrary to standard interpretations, the Italian trio wasn't really endorsing hierarchies, but in fact was warning us about them. I'm not convinced, but here she is to make her case. Natasha Piano. The term the Italian school of elitism refers mostly to three writers, Pareto, Mosca, and Michels, who was originally a German, but he seems to have achieved honorary Italianness. Now, the three aren't identical, as we'll find out as we talk, but what are the commonalities that unite them as a school of thought?
Yes, exactly. The Italian school of elitism, they do share commonalities, just not the ones that have been typically assumed. The first and the most obvious is that they all rejected this kind of Marxist fairy tale that economic inequalities could be entirely abolished in some sort of communist future. Socialists who predicted this kind of classless society, mistakenly, the Italians thought, anticipated a society in which there would be no elites. But the Italians thought that it was a problem to think that the answer to elite domination is simply to eliminate elites. For the Italians, the problem of elite domination is intractable. It's kind of like a numerical problem. In every society, small cadres of the powerful will form and aspire to dominate large majorities of the powerless. So they worried that socialism kind of breeds a complacency with domination because under certain conditions, it will surrender its vigilance against elite domination, enabling a new elite class to arise. They really rejected this Marxist confidence that revolution could necessarily eliminate elites altogether.
Well, I came to reading these people with a discomfort around the very idea of elites. Coming out of that kind of Marxist background, I thought maybe someday we could eliminate these characters. But partly just from reading them, I really had to rethink this. I don't think elites are necessarily going to go away under at least any imaginable near future. The battle against hierarchy that obsesses so many on the left is a chimerical battle. One has to accept, at least under imaginable social conditions, the inevitability of oligarchy. For years, I resisted Michels' concept of the Iron Law of Oligarchy, but now I'm much more concerned about how to make the inevitable leadership transparent and accountable. So it may be an Iron Law of Oligarchy, but maybe we can manipulate it some. But now you argue that the Italians centered oligarchy in their analysis as a form of critique. Most people read it as endorsement. So now I've gotten a little more confused about this.
Well, that's true. Because they were anti-socialist, it doesn't mean that they were uncritical of parliamentarism or representative politics either. In fact, I think that was one of their biggest concerns because they were living in a super representative moment. I think most importantly, all three of them shared this vigilant, pessimistic approach toward representative institutions in order to combat the inherent plutocratic tendencies arising out of elections, not to resign themselves to the tendencies. The book tries to demonstrate each figure's expressed concern with plutocracy by explaining their most famous empirical theories, you know, the elite circulation theory, the ruling class theory, and the Iron Law of Oligarchy against the backdrop of the Italian post-unification process. Because what that reveals is that the Italians were really, really concerned with plutocratic corruption of liberal institutions. That's really their main goal, was to identify how we could at least combat or contain plutocratic consequences out of elections. Now, this doesn't mean that they rejected representation or electoral politics. To the contrary, they thought that honestly facing the plutocratic challenges arising out of elections was the best way to preserve their legitimacy. They thought that elections were still the best method of leadership selection, but crucially, recognizing the inherent plutocratic elements of electoral politics could encourage external constraints on them so that the inevitable influence of the wealthy doesn't mean plutocratic capture of the entire government. Maybe it's an optimistic orientation, but they've got that honestly facing the inherent plutocratic tendencies in elections could help contain those tendencies instead of amplify them.
Now, it's probably important to emphasize that they were writing at a time when the Italian nation was emerging as a nation. We, of course, live in a country that is the heir to an Anglo-American tradition of representation that goes back centuries. So we have very different historical perspectives here.
Absolutely. I think that it's true. We have to appreciate that the Italians were far more attentive to the plutocratic dangers of parliamentary politics, given their experience with their own unification process. And they were specifically concerned to warn their elite peers that Italy would never survive as a nation, even under conditions of universal suffrage without regional economic redress and other external mechanisms that helped keep representative politics relatively healthy or relatively less corrupt than they otherwise would be. But for Pareto and Mosca in particular, the circulation of elites or competition among them fostered through liberal institutions is simply not enough to qualify a regime as democratic, whether in its modern formulation or otherwise. And I think Americans have a different orientation to that because we have a longer history and a more positive experience with representation. But it's important to appreciate that 100 years ago, we weren't as eager to call ourselves a democracy or identify democracy simply with fair and free elections. Instead, Americans were more regularly understood our society or our regime time as a democratic republic and one that wasn't necessarily a pure democracy, so to speak. I think in the last 50 years, that orientation has changed and we're much more willing to call ourselves democratic.
But we as Americans should also appreciate that the framers of our Constitution wanted to create limits on popular power. It was definitely written by aristocrats who wanted to preserve the rule of the property. So we don't want to overestimate the democratic thrust of our own history.
Absolutely. And that's why I think the Italian lesson or their warning against the conflation of democracy and election, despite our different histories, is really relevant today because Mosca and Pareto aim to spur elites to correct the plutocratic corruption that was rampant in the Italian version of a liberal electoralism because they thought that identifying democracy as free and fair election was actually dangerous to both representative politics and democratic politics. They thought that it was a problem. They thought that there was a few different potential dangers in that conflation. And I think that we are feeling those or we're appreciating those dangers today more than we ever have.
Now, I think there's an old Marxist view of elections under capitalism that, you know, every 4 years or so, the masses get to choose which members of the elite will exploit them. I don't think all these guys would quite agree with the phrasing of that, but there are some commonalities in that view.
Absolutely. The reason why Pareto and Mosca and even Michels were so intent on combating Marxism is because they thought that it was too optimistic, but that they shared some of those sympathies and wanted to redirect it in a more what they called realistic or pessimistic direction. Even though they were explicitly anti-socialist figures, they were concerned with generating democratic expectations out of elections because they thought that elections will never deliver democratic results or not intended to. And so making mass publics expect that out of elections would just sully the benefits of electoral leadership selection.
One of the major features of Italian politics was and still is the disparities between the North and the South. We see a lot of political tensions in the U.S. now between the coastal regions and the heartland. Some of the Italian experience is not irrelevant to our own present situation.
I don't think so at all. In fact, in reviving these figures, I don't mean to deny that elections are a crucial mechanism in modern mass popular government. But for the Italians, the issue isn't that we needed to find checks to electoral corruption lest Mr. Moneybags becomes our representative, as important as it is to do so. But the problem kind of runs deeper. The problem lies in attributing democratic power to election because it holds us captive to an image of democracy as representative government that's made us lose track of what democracy is and kind of what it should be. The Italians help us theoretically disconnect the seemingly natural connection between elections and democracy. And it's only once these two concepts are analytically separated that we can begin to see that they're not the same, but that they came to be seen as the same in a historically contingent manner, which is precluding us from fully embracing the benefits of both. I think their bold theoretical claim is that competitive election is an instrument of representation, not an instrument of democracy. And representation and democracy are two distinct concepts that work in a mutually constitutive way in order to preserve this contemporary iteration of popular government we now call liberal democracy, right? So in recovering their thought, there are a few takeaways, a few things that we can at least think about in our own moment. They offer this idea that democracy requires constant vigilance against the ever-present threat of plutocracy internal to electoral systems through majoritarian institutions that are external to elections. And external mechanisms are crucial so that the inevitable influence, like I said, of the wealthy doesn't result in plutocratic capture of the entire government, just as elections and constitutionally guaranteed rights are crucial in protecting minorities from the tyranny of the majority. So the warning against identifying democracy with election isn't just a semantic issue. They diagnose two distinct but related threats to the legitimacy of popular government. And the first is that equating elections and democracy conceals the plutocratic threats of representative systems. They claim that the connection between electoral institutions and plutocratic governance must be constantly exposed and combated, not fallaciously described as democratic, because otherwise popular government devolves into this contest between competing sets of plutocrats that we unconvincingly call, you know, democracy. And I think we currently face this precise conundrum in our own plutocratic moment. Liberal political parties are coming under increasing attack from disillusioned citizens who can, as the Italians warned, credibly contend that elections do not generate public officials who genuinely represent them or even act in their own interests. And that's the first threat. The second threat, this plutocratic threat, brings us to the second risk in pairing election with democracy, and that's the demagogic. I think viewing elections as a democratic expression of popular sovereignty gives potential demagogues, you know, often demagogues who are themselves plutocrats, the ability to claim that they truly represent the will of the people, endowing them with this unfounded right to rule that becomes difficult to dispute.
That sounds like the current occupant of the Oval Office, really.
I wish that they weren't so right about this. But I think once elections are understood as a democratic tool par excellence, a leader can claim democratic legitimacy to do as she pleases, even though election alone doesn't confer that right. But just think of demagogues who win an election and claim the people have spoken. And the issue isn't that elections may occasionally produce dangerous leaders, but that the democratic power we attribute to elections enables such leaders to characterize themselves as the voice of the people, allowing them to deal a death blow to popular government writ large. So I think putting these two risks together reveals the Italians' realist critique of elections, that the idea that more enfranchisement leads to more democracy is a dangerous fantasy. And the reality is that mass enfranchisement still allows for some plutocracy to persist, leading to mass disillusionment with electoral government and loss of faith in the system, resulting in increased appeal for demagogic alternatives because people feel like they don't have any other choice. When there are no institutional mechanisms to express a voice of dissent, they think electing a demagogic leader might reveal or suggest something about a dissatisfaction with the overall system as opposed to simply particular political candidates or not finding candidates that adequately represent their desires and needs. Basically, I think that the Italians have a lot to offer us despite having these very different historical contexts because they argue that identifying democracy with election is dangerous because it conceals the threat of plutocracy and generates unrealistically democratic expectations that elections on their own, at least, will never deliver. And I think we're facing that right now.
I'm speaking with the political scientist Natasha Piano, author of Democratic Elitism from Harvard University Press. Okay, so we've been talking generally. Let's talk about the individual members of this power trio. I'm guessing most listeners know little about them. People who've been through economics probably know Pareto optimality and maybe his 80-20 rule. Some people are probably familiar with the concept of the iron law of oligarchy from Mickels. But yeah, let's go through each of these guys in turn. What are the, you know, the outstanding features of Pareto's thought?
Pareto, I don't know if he's my favorite, but I'm definitely attracted to the underdog. And Pareto has been an underdog in the political science discipline because he's considered the most pessimistic and he's a downer, you know?
He also seems like a bit of a nut with all the strange language and the diagrams.
Oh, like, absolutely. At some point, you know, he had a nervous breakdown and his wife famously left him for the Russian cook, and that induced him to many years of being a cat lady in his villa in Chavigny. So he faced plenty of obstacles on his own. But I think the red thread in his thought is that he was probably the most explicit about the warning of against the conflation of election and democracy. Each of the Italian school theorists analyzes different features of representative politics to reveal how electoral procedures enhance elite domination of the majority. But Pareto in particular highlights the connection between governing and non-governing elites to show that parliamentary elections render politicians beholden to military, but mostly financial leaders by virtue of economic interests. And so he was really interested in uncovering this kind of facade that parliamentary politics puts up, where there's this very formal distinction between financial and political elites. And he was very motivated to expose the plutocratic corruption that results from financial and political elite collusion. So I think that's the dominant characteristic. He thought that elections and representative politics necessarily cultivates this in the ancient Roman republics and today. But capitalism makes this phenomenon acute because there are more combinations and potential combinations for collusion between financial and military and political elites. He found himself to be trying to expose that kind of corruption that he thought always lived in parliamentary politics or electoral politics. So that's maybe the most important element of his thought. And I think he was the best at identifying how there are different types of elites. And he was interested in identifying different categories of elites that kind of transcended this elite versus mass binary.
He was a real stickler for taxonomies. He was dividing.
You know, he was a stickler for taxonomies, but he at length discusses problematic features of speculators and rentiers and liberal regimes and how the speculators might be induced through financial incentives to collude against majorities and land owning elites even. And so it kind of just prompts this. Surely speculators and rentiers still exist as categories today. So his thought kind of beckons us to think beyond elites as this broader category and really understand what makes up a political elite, what their connections between financial elites and different kinds of binaries like speculators and rentiers that might be applicable in our own moment.
Okay, and now Mosca.
Mosca details the ways minorities use the organization of representative institutions to increase their access to wealth and consequently consolidate their power under the color of a democratic facade. So he was particularly concerned by this idea that universal suffrage or this myth of universal suffrage, and I think Pareto shared this, but Mosca too was worried that this idea that once you give everyone suffrage, that was going to alleviate economic inequalities or elite domination. In fact, he thought that it would allow it to continue because once you have universal suffrage, northern capitalist elites in Italy could say, oh, look, you know, we're not exploiting anyone. There's just democratic elections going on where everyone's entitled to vote. But given, you know, problems with electoral politics, especially in Italy at the time, voter intimidation, fraud. He was worried that that actually wasn't going to reflect interests and instead encourage alliance between democratic southern barons oppressing masses in the south and northern industrial capitalists, and that the system wouldn't really change, even though it would be given the appearance of a new regime because universal suffrage formally existed.
And then Michels, the alien, the German.
The alien, the German, or the Italian naturalized German, yes. Michels investigates political party structure to conclude that parties require a necessarily plutocratic organization to advance their platforms, a feature that kind of precludes egalitarian distribution of resources and power. Michels doesn't necessarily call it plutocratic. He calls it oligarchic. He's less sensitive to the specific problems posed by plutocracy versus oligarchy. But nevertheless, in investigating political party structure, I mean, he's concerned with the influence of wealth and how that precludes this egalitarian distribution of resources and power that democracy often requires. Pareto highlights this connection between governing and non-governing elites to show how parliamentary elections make them beholden to financial and military, and in our case, tech leaders. And Mosca's thinking differently about organization, and Michels' focus is on the political party structure of liberal electoral politics.
Michels has 5 delightful pages or so on the role of class traitors in socialist politics, and how many of the socialist leadership in the past has been high bourgeois, which is something that is important and greatly underappreciated.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a crux of his argument, is the focus on these class traitors and how they become almost more offensive because of the hypocrisy. But he wants to show it, that it's a structural phenomenon and not a personal one.
The risk, of course, is the elites become hereditary because the advantages that they confer upon their children, education and exposure to power and habitus and those sorts of things, are transmissible. So it's hard to become a leader out of nowhere.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, Pareto and Mosca recognized that and accepted it, but thought that in order to convince elites to impose restraints on themselves, they thought that they needed to be honest about that to demonstrate that these classes become hereditary and then decay or become corrupt as a result. So they thought that admitting this feature was actually productive because elites could try to convince elites to impose restraints on themselves only if to keep their own power, but maybe that was an overly optimistic
thing. I think, yeah. Well, you quote that bit from The Leopard, right, about everything has to change in order for things to remain the same.
Yeah.
They have no incentive, really, in the short term to want to give up any of their power or status.
Exactly. So in some sense, you know, I'm arguing against myself a little bit, but in some sense you could see that as wildly an optimistic position, right, that they thought that this could perhaps influence them to curtail their power, and that they were so worried that the state would collapse if they didn't. Elites didn't have any other choice. Now, I think their peers felt differently, but.
Yeah, now these elites, we should say, are not fixed, frozen structures for Pareto. They rise and fall, circulation. For Mosca, it's important to have replenishment from below to maintain a certain vitality as an elite. Sidney Bolzell, in his work in The Wasp, said that the wasps had become a caste because they were just too close to that fresh blood. That is really important for an elite to maintain itself, is to at least admit some outsiders for some lively inspiration.
Absolutely. And it's not just about competence. You know, they most are worried that the hereditary elite always decayed because of, you know, lack of external pressure, but it was also because co-optation, to put it pessimistically, helped encourage elites to listen or hear majoritarian desires and demands, which ultimately, as Pareto argued, is kind of like the source of elite power. You know, an elite comes to be an elite because they're able to be responsive to majoritarian desires and needs. So there's so much emphasis in elite theory on the circulation of elites, on the fact that you can trace history, use elite theory as a heuristic to understand the rise and falls of all of different societies. Pareto in particular, but also Mosca, was always explicit that a true elite or genuine aristoi, leaders who genuinely deserve to be considered as such, come to be because they are more responsive to a majoritarian need that hasn't been addressed by a decaying or corrupt ruling class.
Now, I came to all this because I was very interested in the current state of the American ruling class, which you read in my article from Jacobin, that I think it's a rotten social formation. The centrist part of the elite just seems to lack any ideas or convictions or anything. And then we have this very well-organized crew that surrounds Trump of oligarchs, plutocrats. The frank use of the state to enrich themselves, ruled by people for very, very narrow sets of interests. What do these three writers tell you about our current situation?
They hoped in the early part of their lives, you know, when as young economists and political thinkers, they had hoped that identifying these limitations with elites could encourage the equivalent of centrist politicians to be more bold, to actually be more responsive to majoritarian desires, to be better elites, right? I think that they hoped that in the early part of their careers, which is why they were so insistent on identifying the plutocratic corruption inherent in liberal politics. As time moved on, they were worried that the lack of real leadership that's responsive to majoritarian needs would enable a more, as you say, rotting or corrupt or explicit identification with oligarchy to emerge out of a liberal parliamentary system. And in so doing, because the lack of faith in liberalism or electoral politics had been already established by decades of disillusionment, that a demagogue would come on the scene and be more appealing or attractive because mass public felt like liberal politics weren't really giving them the kind of responses that they needed, that were required. So in terms of today's political landscape, they would blame elites and not the masses, which is an important point of elite theory, that you don't blame mass epistemic capacities for elite insufficiency. You blame elite sufficiency as the cause of the problem, because mass epistemic capacities doesn't really address the issue of leadership or decaying or rotting leadership. So I think that's an important inversion to the story, that the Italian school of elitism is mostly concerned with the lack of quality of elites, and it's taking to task their elite peers for this, not blaming any mass publics for inability to achieve some policy preference or another. You know, that wasn't really their concern. And I think that's an important takeaway.
I'm thinking of Hillary Clinton and the deplorables.
Well, me too. You know, I grew up in, I came of age in that moment where there was so much left criticism of, you know, in the 90s, you know, there was so much criticism of Hillary. And then there was a strange inversion where then it became the public's fault that Hillary Clinton lost the election, or that people didn't understand their own interests. And that's just really not the case. It was more a vote of dissent as opposed to not understanding your own interests. I think it was a misplaced blame, which I think liberals and conservatives, you know, everyone on the political spectrum in the United States is guilty of deflecting the responsibility onto majorities. When I think that's the symptom, not the cause of the problem.
Yeah, if you conflate democracy and elections, given that people are not really given a whole array of choices, they sometimes just flip their ruling class the bird by voting for the crazy guy.
Exactly. Well, when you identify democracy as election, you really have no choice but to say, make an exception or an excuse for every outcome we don't like. Like, oh, this is different. Oh, it's because of the Electoral College. Oh, because of, you know, it's not the case that elections are necessarily supposed to reflect majoritarian decisions. That's just not how they work. They've never worked like that. So maybe we should rethink how we understand democracy and election. And I think we're already subconsciously doing that as a result of our experience in the last 20 years with this long-durée electoral cycle, where the definition of democracy as free and fair election doesn't really seem to jive with our own instincts anymore.
That was Natasha Piano, a political scientist at UCLA and author of Democratic Elites, published by Harvard University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some Italian hyper-modernist music from the elitist era, a 1930 composition by Giacinto Scelsi, his Rotativa, performed by Marco Andrias, Marco Marzacchi, Aris Ludi, and Christina Biagini. Till next week, bye.